From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for the last day of September 2022. Checking the calendar for this week, and it's that time of year when sports schedules collide. The Brewers wrap up the regular season this week with Miami and Arizona at AmFam. Your Milwaukee Bucks preseason starts Saturday at Fiserv with the Memphis Grizzlies. And the Packers are in New England Sunday with the Patriots. And today, Friday, it's Old Fashioned Fest at Turner Hall. Nothing screams Milwaukee louder than a brandy old-fashioned suite. A 63-year-old Arabian man has married 53 women, mostly one at a time. One marriage lasted all of 4 days. He said he's been looking for stability in his life. A great wedding present would have been a dictionary so he could look up the definition of stability. Some of the problems NASA scientists are trying to figure out are how to harvest water on the moon, how to construct sustainable, livable housing on Mars, and how to have sex in space. No one likes to talk about that, but that's why you have me. In case you're wondering, space sexology is a real thing. So far, 600 people have gone to space, and the official NASA position is it hasn't happened yet. But when it does, they'll have to redefine the Mile High Club. I think we have a theme here. A couple feeling frisky had sex in his car. Remember, it's his car. Well, they exchanged phone numbers, and of course, they exchanged STDs. The woman then sued Geico, the guy's insurance company, figuring his liability insurance would cover her damages. And after a lot of legal wrangling, Geico paid out $5.2 million to settle the claim. Who knew that little gecko had that kind of money? And finally, a Japanese scientist developed a TV screen that viewers can lick to taste the displayed foods. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. On the podcast today, we have Steve Giles, Mike Helsel, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, a lot to work with this week, Max, but mostly one at a time. Overall, a rough week for stocks. The NASDAQ down 2.7% this week, closing at 10,576. The S&P down 2.9%, closing well below June's prior lows for the year. Down again 2.9% this week, closing at 3586. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average also down 2.9%, down 860 points this week after losing 495 points on Friday to close the quarter. For the year, the Dow now down 19.6%, the S&P down 23.8%, and the NASDAQ down 32%. Benchmark 10-year U.S. Treasury yield moved meaningfully higher this week, closing at 3.8%. Another sign, perhaps, that inflation continues to be on the minds of so many as the Fed continues down the path of rate hikes, as the inflation landscape continues to seem to point to the Fed needing to take some more action. But maybe this week, Steve, we start with just some of the devastation that was wrought as Hurricane Ian made landfall in Florida, as we're recording, now making landfall in South Carolina, and maybe need to begin that conversation with just a reminder that this is still a situation that's very much ongoing, plenty of destruction, plenty of lives ruined here, and so I need to tread lightly, I think, on that, but also understand that there's going to be significant economic consequences to deal with for a long time to come.
And I think it's a reminder, too, Kyle, that there are a lot more important things than what the market is doing on a daily basis. Casualty loss of property, loss of life is certainly real, and we wish the best to those that are trying their best to dig out from what has been a horrible situation.
Yeah, such an important reminder, Steve, and obviously need to touch on it just given what's going on currently, but want to spend just a little bit more time talking about, some of the devastation in the stock market recently. In particular, you look at the third quarter, a third consecutive quarter of declines, pretty atypical to get that kind of, poor run from the stock market. Certainly as we look at, you know, areas of the market that have been challenged, it's just about everything. And it's not just stocks, it's been bonds along with it. You know, Steve, I think as we kind of look at what this third quarter has brought us, a reminder perhaps that, you know, there's some potential volatility left.
Yeah, absolutely, Kyle. And I think it's important for investors to be reminded that what we're living through now is probably your standard garden variety bear market. On average, a bear market, which is a pullback of more than 20% from recent highs, is now being experienced by all the major indices, NASDAQ, S&P, and Dow Jones, all off more than 20% from their highs earlier the year in January. But the average bear market is about 9.5 months long. We've had 27 bear markets, Kyle, since 1928. And over that time, only 15 recessions, which I think is worth pointing out, because when you go through a period of stock market weakness and stock market sell-off, the I think first knee-jerk reaction is that, well, the sky is falling and everything is going to be really bad. And as you and I both know, while the first half of this year saw two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth, which is a lot of the times what everybody will tell us is the economy in a recession, we're certainly not in a recession. The component that has not yet signaled the fact that this economy is in a recession is consumer spending. That has stayed very, very strong, and also unemployment near 50-year lows.
Yeah, I think those are critical points, right? As we look at, you know, kind of so many people looking at GDP report. Joel, we got a finalized version of the second quarter GDP report this week. Yeah, okay, negative growth from a GDP perspective, but because of some of the nuance, the National Bureau of Economic Research maybe not quite willing to indicate that we're there yet, but, you know, at least, you know, shed some light on that second quarter GDP report.
Yeah, Kyle, that's the group that the National Bureau of Economic Research is the group that officially announces whether we're in a recession or not. And the last time they did that was 2020, of course, because of the devastation from you know, the beginning of the coronavirus. And they, when they announced that last recession, they specifically mentioned two things that made it a recession. One was, as Steve said, employment. Employment, you know, nobody was working then. The other thing that they mentioned was industrial output. And as Steve mentioned, employment is strong. Industrial output is actually pretty good right now, too. You know, we had a report this week that durable goods orders were down slightly for only the second time in a long while. And that GDP report, the final look at the second quarter, actually showed that consumer spending in the second quarter was higher than they originally estimated. And we had further a report today from the Bureau of Economic Analysis that consumer spending was up again in August, and it's only been down for like 2 months out of the last 18.
I think it's worth pointing out that the contraction we've seen in the GDP numbers for the first half of this year was trade-related, which is an important point to make as we look at some of the other economic indicators.
Yeah, and of course, the trade numbers influenced by so much of what's happening in the rest of the world. Mike, you've looked quite a bit at some of that stuff, and in particular, you know, kind of the impact that that's had on inflation, the impact that's had maybe on dollar strength. A big component of that has just been kind of the global supply chains.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about the inflation conversation, right here it's been dominated by interest rate hikes, right? But kind of the supply chain part of it has been pushed to the side, right? Because it's much easier to say, just to look at numbers and say it's going up, gas prices going up, all that stuff. But when you look at the supply chain issue, that can help with the inflation piece, right? And one of the things that you guys touched on, trade being one of them, shipping prices were really high for a long time because of inflation, right? Now they're starting to come back down, right? So I wrote down some numbers that basically from Shanghai to LA now, shipping container prices have fallen 74%, right? So that's easing off some of the inflationary pressure there. I mean, they used to cost, a 40-foot container used to be about between $10,000 and $11,000, and now it's $3,700, right? So now businesses can ship more and kind of help the supply chain out and get more goods back into the market. So when you kind of when you look at what's happening overseas with those shipping prices, as the inflationary let me take it back. I'm glad I work with numbers and not words. As the supply chain eases, right, the pressure on it eases, that's going to help drive inflation down, right? And so I think people need to start paying attention a little bit more to that when they're worried about inflation, because it is a real thing. But as these prices go down and more goods can flood like the market, that's going to ease off on prices, and that's just going to help the inflation picture overall.
Well, and I think we spend so much time talking about the Fed's impact on inflation, and you know the Fed has an impact. We can talk about maybe what that is, but I think it's important to point out that as much as it was a problem with easy money, it was also a problem with a lack of goods to meet demand. And so, you know, if it's a little easier to get those goods you want to purchase from Shanghai to LA, well, okay, now a little easier for me to go ahead and buy them. Maybe it's a little cheaper to do it. But Joel, I know a question that we were kind of batting around before the show kind of relates to maybe your thoughts on what role the Fed really plays in damping down kind of spending.
Right. You know, because we're continuing to see that consumers are spending. We had retail numbers, I think, last week that show that people are spending more money at stores. And even if you correct for inflation, they're spending more money at stores. We have the numbers today showing that consumer spending continues up. It's up 18% since before the COVID pandemic. It's at a record high, consumer spending. So, we know that consumer spending drives 70% of GDP. So at some point, I mean, if we want to see the economy slowing down, I think that's the Fed's intention to control inflation better. I guess we'd want to see consumer spending hold back a little. But there's, you know, part of the problem that, you know, Mike's talking about with inflation was that there was pent-up demand because of COVID and people just wanting to buy stuff and they couldn't. And then the problem of, you know, not being able, the shippers not being able to get the stuff to them. So that drove up inflation and prices were rising fast. We got evidence this week that those inflation numbers are starting to slow down, you know, in the last month or so, but we don't know how long that'll be sustained. But yeah, so my question was, at what point would we want to see that consumer spending is being curbed by the higher interest rates?
Yeah, and I think the short answer to that question is it doesn't happen overnight. And it doesn't happen overnight for a number of reasons, but one of them is that early on in rising rates, consumers haven't really seen the impact of it yet for a variety of reasons, and we can touch on that in a second. But, you know, early on, you're spending cash you still have in your pocket, especially in this particular case. You know, consumers were sitting on piles of cash early on. They weren't spending beyond their means because their means were far higher post-COVID than they had been prior to COVID. We've gotten to a point now where some of those debt levels have started to rise, some revolving debt in particular, things like credit card spend have started to pick up. You would think that interest rates, as the Fed is raising them, start to make their way into consumer credit. They start to make it more expensive to do some of that short-term borrowing. It doesn't happen overnight. Credit card companies are slow to adjust, certainly. And consumers aren't as sensitive to that as maybe what you'd expect. And the reason for that is a lot of the spending that takes place is necessities, not discretion. You go to the grocery store, you buy groceries, you're going to put it on your credit card, even if it means you're spending a little more today than you did yesterday. You're not all that concerned about what the interest rates are. And so much of our consumption, 70% of gross domestic product, as you point out, so much of our consumption is things that we're going to spend on no matter what the price is because we have to. The bigger picture, though, is that the Fed controls things like the interest rates for mortgages indirectly, but in a very real way, and maybe as importantly, what it costs corporations to borrow. The problem is not everyone is in those markets every day, right? It might be 6 months between when a big corporation has to borrow one bond issuance to the next bond issuance. And a lot of corporations did a lot of their borrowing when interest rates were still really low. And so the Fed's response to raise interest rates doesn't get felt by those people that don't need to borrow. If you've got cash, if you already borrowed, it doesn't cost you any more right now, especially if you were able to borrow at low rates and those rates were fixed. And so when we say that it takes time for the Fed's response for rising rates to be felt by the economy, that's a big part of it is these businesses aren't out there borrowing every day. Consumers aren't out there making big ticket purchases every day. And so it gets felt over time as those purchases start to pile up, either because consumers go, well, rates are going to go back down, and so I can hold off. I'll wait until I can buy that house when it's 3.5 or 4 instead of 6 where the 30-year mortgage is right now, or because car rates are lower, or because their credit card rate looks a little better and it makes more sense. Or businesses, and again, I think businesses are the far bigger piece of this puzzle right now, go, well, we're going to spend the cash we have rather than issue a new bond, rather than issue more debt, because it would just be way more cost effective to do it that way.
And Kyle, I mean, excuse me, this is a great explanation. And actually talking about mortgages, we had news this week from several sources that you know, we're actually seeing effects of that, of the higher mortgage rates on, you know, on the home industry. And the National Association of Realtors figures that their home sales this year are going to be 15% lower than last year, and next year are going to be 7% lower than this year.
And, you know, two significant reasons for that. One is higher rates, but the second is what we saw from Kay Schiller, that while price increases are starting to slow, year over year, price gains are still substantial. So I think, you know, critically important to understand there's an affordability issue now. That affordability issue becomes even more relevant when you have interest rates that have risen as significantly as they have. And as you and I have been talking about for the last week, the pace of that rate increase has been some of the fastest we've ever seen. Certainly, you know, in the history of the Fed doing this kind of stuff, to see the rate at which they've raised has been, you know, pretty substantial.
Which lends to why we're seeing as much volatility in the market, Kyle. The Fed did not wait to see the impact or the effect of earlier rate increases from the summer. June, July, August, September, before they continued to raise rates, where there are a lot of those in the market that would rather the Fed wait to see what impact raising rates had from earlier in the summer before they continue to raise. But Powell has been very adamant about inflation being public enemy number one, and he is not going to hold any punches as they embark down this path of trying to stave off inflation.
You know, Mike, I want to pull back here for just a second to what was a rough third quarter. What's been interesting to me the last couple of weeks is the number of headlines out there about whether it's market prognosticators talking about what they think the S&P is going to fall to. Well, a lot of those predictions have come true. Or whether it's just the folks out there that are convinced that it's going to be a while before things get better. You know, it reminds me of, you know, the old saying, you know, about the time to buy is when there's blood in the streets. I think, you know, while we may or may not be there yet, you know, a reminder that when all the people that want to sell have sold, well, that's a pretty good time to look to start buying.
Yeah, you and I were talking about it earlier this week about how actually, a lot of the negative headlines that you see is actually kind of a good thing right now for the market, because it's driving people. All the people that want to sell are going to sell, and eventually they're going to run out. And that's when it's a good time to buy, because, again, we've said this a few times on this podcast, that for the first time in a long time, stocks are cheap, right? And it's the classic buy low opportunity. So if everyone is sold and that's just sitting there, people are going to have cash and they're going to put it to work in some stocks. And I mean, we're starting to get a bit of a clearer picture on when the turnaround could be. So I think this could be a good time for people to get back in. But again, going back to the negative headlines, I think you have to look at it as sometimes bad news is good news if you're looking to buy stocks. So just be aware of that as you look at the headlines. And as I've said numerous times on the show, when you watch the TV shows, my advice is please don't. But when you have all of the flashing red lights in the headlines saying stocks are going down, it's never going to turn around, just maybe think, this might be the time for me to get back in because this could be the opportunity I was waiting for.
Yeah, unfortunately, Mike, human beings are always victims of our most recent perceptions, and we tend to extrapolate what's happened most recently out into the future. But I'll tell you what, I'm not selling. And for that reason alone, I know the market's not going to go to zero. I'll be the only guy left. But the point here is that we get to that market capitulation, yeah. And if everybody that wanted to sell is sold, the only people left holding stocks are those long-term buy and hold investors, our clients. The only place for the market to go is up.
You know, I think one of the kind of foundational books that we've kind of used as the way we view investing is Jeremy Siegel's Stocks for the Long Run. The sixth edition of the book comes out. Not that he needs me to plug his book, but the sixth edition of that book comes out in a couple of weeks. So Siegel's out doing the book press circuit right now and getting asked about the Fed, getting asked about where he sees opportunities. And I think it's interesting this week he pointed out the Fed may be making the largest mistake they've made in 100-plus years in going so far so quickly and not stopping to digest what the impact has actually been. The very things we were talking about earlier, the very things we've been talking about for weeks, you know, Siegel, professor at Wharton School of Business, comes out and says very much the same stuff we're talking about, but also at the end of those comments and in some other comments he's made, talking about how, you know, long-term, stocks are still the place to be, right? That you bet on earnings, and you bet in particular on U.S. corporations who have done such an incredible job over extended periods of time of capturing those earnings. It's why we come back to cautious optimism. It's why we take the balanced approach we take, because it gets us the time we need to see some of that longer-term view. You know, Joel, I think the other big thing worth pointing out, Bob Landis and I spent a good 45 minutes kind of talking about markets, the economy, putting together a video that we will use for our seminar this year. Still hoping to get back to doing in-person seminars in the future. But, you know, as we continue to deal with some of the effects of COVID, this year wasn't the year for that. But we've got that seminar video coming out this afternoon.
That's right. And I thought you and Bob did a good job of putting in perspective all of the circumstances that we have right now in the market that investors are looking at. And then moving beyond that, just sort of saying, this is why we got here and this is how we feel about what might be ahead.
And of course, you know, a conversation, Steve, with you and I as part of that as well, talking about how we navigate the very issues that we've been talking about, it seems like, for weeks on this podcast.
Yeah, that's right, Kyle. We talked about bear markets. And I think for me, the takeaway is always be prepared before it comes. It's, you know, how do you survive a car crash? Well, make sure your seatbelt's on.
That's a great point. I think, you know, you add in conversations with Dave Sandstrom and I talking about kind of what the Fed actually is tasked with, what their role is, what that means, a conversation with Kendall Bauer on kind of the benefits of higher interest rates, and of course, Paige Radke chipping in with, I think, a pretty important and timely conversation about some of the changing dynamics between value and growth right now. I think a pretty entertaining, interesting podcast. I invite you all, if you aren't subscribed to our newsletter, please do that. It'll get you kind of the quickest access to it. You can always go to our website and see it as well.
Kudos to Jason Skuglik for the work that he did to put that together. And one thing that we've got that's different this year in the video, too, is that we have chapters. So you can more easily find where Dave and Steve and Kendall and Paige are in that piece of video too.
I think my Milwaukee Bucks season preview got cut out of the seminar, so that's
it
okay.
Did.
That's okay.
Sorry,
I don't take it.
Maybe next year when we're in person.
Yeah,
I don't take it personally.
Jason was not even recording video for that conversation, so unfortunately, it did get missed. But feel free if you've got any questions on Bucks season preview to give Mike a call.
Sorry, Mike.
It's okay.
Well, as always, we enjoy doing the show. Again, please check out the newsletter. Please check out the seminar video that's going up on our YouTube channel, our website, and out in the newsletter this afternoon. And we look forward to talking to all of you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.